Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the fifth program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is the third in our series on the rolling constitutional crisis. This week, our show is called, Is Our Government Making Us Sick? We'll talk about the effects of federal administration policies on health and science research and delivery nationally and here in Maine. This show was pre-recorded on May 14th. Send your comments to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum. Let me introduce our guests. We're pretty excited to have this group of people together with us today. Art Blank is the former CEO of MDEI Hospital and a close observer of the medical and health scene here in Maine. Welcome, Art.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Amy Fried is a professor emerita of political science at the University of Maine and has been on the show with us a few times before. Welcome, Amy.
Great to be back with you.
And Nirav Shah is well known to most of our listeners. He's the former director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention and a former principal deputy director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann. I'm looking forward to it.
All right, let's get started. I'm going to ask you first, Nirav, what are the most concerning things you're seeing happening right now in terms of budget cuts that affect health science and rent medicine?
Again, thank you so much for the opportunity to have this conversation. And I'm going to focus that question specifically on the public health realm, and specifically even there within the proposed budget cuts and the discussion that's been happening at the US CDC level. Even though that conversation is occurring at the national level, make no mistake, the outcomes of those negotiations will affect every single one of us in Maine. There are a few things in particular that are of concern. One is not just the budget cut per se, but particularly the impact it will have on our readiness to respond and detect the next pandemic. None of us knows when the next pandemic will be happening, but I think we all have a sense now in the aftermath of COVID that whenever it happens, it will happen quickly and it will only be a plane ride away. We need to be able to detect that pandemic and then respond as quickly as possible if we want to maintain maximal readiness. The cuts that have been discussed will hamper that ability. An interrelated point to that is another area in which the budgetary approach is of concern is in the erosion of the U.S. government's global footprint. And again, confining my analysis to the public health realm, the CDC has a robust global presence. Indeed, it's those boots on the ground in other parts of the world that actually help us detect the upsurge of a disease that might ultimately come to the U.S. And then the third area that I will comment very briefly on are cuts that are proposed to CDC's work in chronic disease. Not only is chronic disease prevention important, it's a major part of what CDC does, whether it's around obesity, diabetes, or substance use and addiction work. Those cuts are in and of themselves concerning. They also raise questions about what the true priority is of the administration. Is it actually about making America healthy, or is it about budgetary austerity? So those are just a few of the things that are keeping me up at night lately.
In the public health realm. So, like, what is the magnitude of the cuts that are being proposed?
They're very significant. And again, none of us knows exactly how the budget will come out. So we're all very much in the negotiation stage. But based on the tea leaves and the plans and blueprints that have been put forth, the CDC's budget could go down by several billion dollars. The CDC is an $11 to $12 billion agency. To put that in perspective, that's about the size of the state government of Maine. And the cuts that have been proposed, and some of which have already been effectuated, the legality of which is still under debate via the Impoundment Act, but those are already on the order of several billions of dollars.
Amy, yeah, go ahead, Amy.
Yeah, one thing just from a health policy point of view that I'd want to point out is not only are there costs to those cuts in terms of public health that it's going to hurt people. People are going to be sicker, more people will die, but also it probably won't save money. I mean, in fact, it probably will cost more money if you have more hospitalizations, severe illnesses. One thing a doctor friend of mine pointed out is to me one time is there's not really a distinction the way a lot of people think of it in terms of like the impact of viruses versus chronic diseases. There are viruses that cause chronic diseases. We have long COVID. We have the impact also if you don't vaccine, girls for HPV, there's higher rates of cervical cancer. So, you know, the cuts ultimately will probably cost more money in the long run.
Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, and the only other point that I'd want to make is, as we think about today, there is such a freeze in planning throughout the public health community, at least in the public health community I'm aware of. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And the loss of momentum in a variety of areas from substance use disorder treatment to environmental accommodations, all of those things, even if we were to flip the switch tomorrow and restore the budget integrity that we've had, there's significant amount of damage that's going to transpire.
And that sort of fits in thinking of public health with the aversion to vaccines and the failure to embrace and promote vaccination as a strategy against, well, the measles outbreak, for example. I see you nodding, Nero. Go ahead.
Well, you're right. I mean, we started by talking about the budgetary implications of some of the changes, but of course, the tepid at best endorsement of the measles vaccine by Secretary Kennedy is in many respects a coded message to those who are on the fence. And it's a notion, it's a tacit notion that maybe the vaccine isn't something they need to do for their kids. We've already seen a significant outbreak and a very significant uptick in measles cases this year in places that are un or under vaccinated, West Texas, et cetera. The fear that folks have is that those outbreaks could become replicated and we would see these several hundreds of cases that have crept up start occurring elsewhere. And ultimately, that may mean that the United States could lose its status as having eliminated measles. And you might say, well, what's the big deal? We lose our status. But that's a significant backtrack in public health. And we can come back to this, but one of the bigger concerns that I have about the approach to health policy, specifically public health policy, is that it harkens back to a world where the thinking is things were better in America, the 1950s. But certainly from a public health perspective and arguably from other perspectives, the world was not better in 1950. And I'm concerned that this approach, a nostalgia-driven approach, will re-enter a world where we're going to have to learn all over again why vaccines were important.
Polio, rubella.
Polio, rubella, pertussis rates are already on the rise nationally, especially in Maine. You mentioned two others, but there are a host of others, meningitis, et cetera, that honestly, a lot of clinicians have not seen since medical school because of vaccinations. It would be unfortunate if we had to go back to that world only to learn once again why vaccinations are so critical.
Go ahead, Art.
Following up on that, I think that one of the core issues for me has been trying to figure out what this administration thinks the role of government is in providing for and organizing public health activity. One of the things, and it relates to a variety of the topics that we may end up covering, is one of the roles of federal government as the only available source for a combined effort nationally to move things forward. I'm not saying that quite well, but the federal government has always been a convener. They've brought the public health community together to solve public health problems, just like they have functioned that way in clinical research. And it's that basic role of convener that I think is being challenged at this point. And it scares me, quite frankly, that we could lose that.
How is this landing in Maine right now? Are we seeing a degradation of our ability to do public health in Maine?
I'll comment very briefly because I've just only returned to Maine, so I don't want to speak with too much here, but I have read and have chatted with my former colleagues at the Maine CDC that some of the cuts that have already been made, these are not budget cuts, but rather the cessation of funding from the US CDC, again, may be contestable, but some of the cessation of funding has already led to suspensions or reductions in different aspects of service. And then, of course, the future budgetary cuts that we're talking about would go even deeper.
Go ahead, Amy.
Well, regarding the whole question about the role of the federal government, I mean, first of all, we need a way to communicate between the states, to the idea that you're going to just send it all back to the states. Well, the national government has a major role when it comes to sharing the information. The CDC is, anyone who's done any kind of medical thing that puts out a weekly report about disease in the country, the morbidity and mortality report. I know that was stopped for a while. I don't know if it's come back, but that's really important. And then also just the role of research in developing new treatments or sharing research findings. I've been interested in biomedical research in general. Not only because I'm a cancer patient, but in part because I am, I have this relatively rare, slow-growing, kind of ovarian cancer, low-grade serous ovarian cancer. But it's just the federal government has been so important when it comes to developing all kinds of scientific research. And really, that goes back to the 19th century with the Department of Agriculture. It was really the first federal agency that did scientific research. But we've just put so much money into NIH, also National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, other agencies, and we're harming the training of new researchers by making the cuts because those research grants funded people working in labs, whether they were everything from postdocs, so people after they got their PhDs, to people in their doctoral training, to people who are master's students, even undergraduates sometimes getting funded, who then may decide to pursue careers. And those people are needed to do the research. They're part of how the work gets done, running the labs. These cuts and are just, I think they're going to have a very long impact, even if it all gets restored. Of course, the longer it goes on, the worse it is.
So we
But
read that Dr. Collins, who was the head of the NIH, the Na National Institute of Health, just resigned a couple of weeks ago. I mean, what does that mean? And of course, we live in an area which has some research, medical, biomedical research going on, and these institutions are going to be hurt locally. I mean, what does that mean for the future of basic research and cures that may have been coming down the line that are not going to be fully developed, I guess, now.
Biomedical research is not absolutely where I, not my absolute expertise, but I certainly know from chatting with colleagues of mine at the NIH, the impact that this will have is significant. However, the more concerning point behind just saying it will be significant is it's one of these insidious problems where the actual impact may never actually be seen because it will be measured in what does not get created. Similarly, with respect to public health cuts, the actual impact will be in a disaster that could have been averted, but we won't ever really know. And the causation link will be attenuated. And so the political impact is marginal, perhaps, because no one, people may not be able to draw a straight line between a budgetary cut in the current fiscal year and something that doesn't materialize, a life-saving drug or a disaster, a fire or response to an infectious disease several years into the future. And that to me is something that is very difficult from a communications perspective, and certainly as a political science matter. The other aspect there that is implicit, again, at least on the public health side, is that the way in which these will materialize when they do will unfortunately be in catastrophic situations. A climate change event that could have potentially been averted, an infectious disease outbreak that could have been stopped at the source rather than waiting until it arrived here. And so it won't be a slow burn. It will be all at once. And that also adds to the potential human impact as well.
I'm going to take a quick station break, then we'll come back to this topic of the research deficit. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is our government making us sick? Our guests this afternoon are Amy Fried, Professor Emerita of Political Science at the University of Maine, Nirav Shah, former director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and also former Principal Deputy Director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Art Blank, former CEO at MDI Hospital. This program was pre-recorded on May 14th. No listener calls are being taken right now. Yeah, so cutting research and cutting biomedical research, cutting research into cures for cancer like yours, Amy, is there a chance that the private sector is going to pick this up and fill the gap? Art's shaking his head. No, go ahead.
Government is the only vehicle we have to express the public will and express the public direction. Private resources are just that. Yes, in certain cases, I am sure there are private interests that may pick up certain things because it's quote unquote in their interests. That's the difference. That's the basic difference between the public sector and the private sector. And research in particular, and again, it's not my area of expertise, but my understanding of the process is that research, all kinds of research, have evolved as an incredible public-private partnership where the public sets the priorities and the private entities do what they do best. And without that public piece, it will certainly lack direction and effectiveness.
Amy, you wrote quite a powerful piece for the Portland Press Herald about this. Why don't you go ahead and expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, one thing that I talked about in this in that piece that relates to this whole question is what was happening with University of Massachusetts decided to not only halt entry into its PhD program in biomedical research, but actually told people who had been accepted for next year that they no longer would be having them come. You know, so these were really, really smart, really hardworking, really well-prepared people who were going to do their doctoral students, and now they're not going to do it. And I quoted a particular doctor at this medical school who, you know, talking about this and talking about the impact on her lab, which does investigations related to pediatric brain cancer. And really, what her research is about is like stuff that's before you develop drugs. It's about how drugs can pass through the brain-blood barrier so that they can get delivered to where the cancer is ultimately. You know, pharmaceutical companies are involved in research and they do fund clinical trials or help to fund them, but it's not going to be at the earlier stage. And that's where you need the government funding. I mean, there's so many treatments now for cancer that are targeted treatments. Well, those would not exist if the federal government hadn't sequenced the human genome, which it did like about 25 years ago.
To pick up on and Amy's point, it's tremendously important. Not long ago, a paper was sent to me that looked into this, and I wish I had read it before this conversation, but a staggeringly high percentage, I believe it was 97 or 99% of the drugs that have been FDA approved in the past X number of years. Again, I can't remember if it was 10 years or 20 years, but close to every single drug that had been FDA approved in recent history had started as an investigation that was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Now, that doesn't mean that every single investigation that the National Institutes of Health supports turns out to yield a drug. That's not the nature of science, nor should we expect it to be that. But the idea that this money, that taxpayers are not getting their money's worth, is simply not the case.
Go ahead, Art.
Yes, and pick up on taxpayer value. This partnership that has developed, that has created so many scientific advances in our country, has really been the economic driver in many cases to this country's success. So it's not just as horrible as the public health implications may be and the loss of scientific success might involve, but it also is a great economic driver that we're going to lose if we don't maintain it.
Some of the institutions that are right here in our neighborhood, Jackson Labs, the MDI Biolab, I mean, these are economic beneficiaries right here in our own area. Are we hearing that they are going to be affected by this?
I jump in since they're my neighbors. What I hear is similar to what I hear in many other sectors, is that they, because of the freezes and the court mandated freezes to federal action, mostly they're suffering from uncertainty and the kinds of, which is having the real today impact of the types of things that Amy mentioned. You know, they're not going to set up a new laboratory in anticipation of a grant, and they're not going to hire the same level of people. The other piece that we're also going to miss is from the broad sweep of actions that have occurred is we have a lot of foreign scientists and students that have fed this great scientific machine that's here in the United States, and those people are becoming less and less interested in joining as well.
Go ahead, Amy.
Yeah, this isn't specifically on research, but I had a conversation with my oncologist in Brewer, Maine, and she said we cannot run without scientists from, you know, without doctors from other countries. And that's certainly true in like the hospitals near me, the hospitals in Bangor. That's another aspect of it. And Dr. Shah mentioned you're not going to see the impact. We won't know, like things just won't have happened. Like there won't have been what could have been. You know, particularly, I think this is going to matter, as he said, with catastrophes, pandemic, you know, all sorts of things that happen, but also like particular communities, because the Trump administration is so intent on cutting anything that has to do with health equity. And, you know, like we all know, like when it comes to maternal mortality, the U.S. doesn't have really good maternal mortality rates. Well, they're particularly bad among Black women. But, you know, that's the kind of programs and research that the Trump administration seems really determined to cut, and they just call it DEI. Some of the earliest public health surveys that I know of, at least, were in, as someone who studied public opinion and the history of public opinion, you know, we're like in London in the late 19th century, people would go around to different neighborhoods and figure out what the problems were and then try to figure out, okay, here's higher rates in this place. So let's try to create some response so that we bring down those rates in that area. And then that helps the entire city, the entire community. But we have an administration that is just completely opposed to ever looking at where the rates are higher, whatever particular populations that they're highest in.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about healthcare delivery in our rural hospitals in a minute, but I did want to talk a little bit about the loss of scientists. Like I've read that other countries are starting to recruit some of our scientists, and Amy mentioned that you know, some of the people, the best people who might have come here before may be afraid to come here now, but may also just not have the funding to come here now. Is this really shifting the global balance of the U.S. leadership in health research and delivery?
I think it will, for a few interrelated reasons. One is talented folks from countries around the globe will want to go where the most cutting edge work is happening. And if they perceive that that will be more difficult or less supported in the United States, they will be delighted to take their brain power and contribute, whether in the UK, whether in Asia, whether in Canada, what have you. The other has already been hinted at, which is the culture of fear that could be created and has already has started in some respects. It's more than an administration saying, we're not going to fund that research because they have a different theory of the funding of science, although that is part of it. It's also this not so subtle xenophobia. We don't want you here. We don't need you here. The scientists we're talking about, they're very portable because it's their brain power. Then so they can move and they certainly will. The implications of that are even more concerning. Beyond the obvious cultural concerns, it will mean that the United States is not only not the leader, but not the initial beneficiary of much of this work. Right now, much of the most cutting-edge pharmaceuticals and medical devices are developed in the United States, and thus we in the United States are the ones who get the first benefits of those. If those treatments and techniques are developed elsewhere, whether it's in Asia, whether it's in Canada or in Europe or elsewhere, it will be folks in those countries who get the first crack at those benefits. And it may be weeks, months, years before we in the United States do. And we're not just talking about drugs. I mean, we're talking about things like surgical techniques, which are constantly being refined by the best and the brightest. And if your spouse, if your parent were to have surgery, you would want them to go to the surgeon who was the most up to date, not 1 or 2 years behind. And that's very much what we risk by not having this talent on the biomedical side come to the US.
Yeah, I saw you nodding there. Art, do you want to throw in?
You know, the workforce shortage that we have in healthcare has been going on for years. And part of the solution for that has been the fact that the United States is an attractive place for doctors and nurses that are trained abroad to come into practice. And if that pipeline gets shut down, clearly the overwhelming challenge that already exists in taking care of our aging population is just going to get that much worse.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Nirav Shah, former director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and former principal deputy director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Also with us, Art Blank, former CEO of MDI Hospital, and Amy Fried, professor emerita of political science at the University of Maine. Our topic today: is our government making us sick? This show was pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. So we were starting to drift into the other topic that I wanted to talk about today, which is, you know, after public health, well, with public health and with, you know, basic science and research, healthcare delivery in rural hospitals. And Art, you started talking about the extent to which our hospitals were, you know, I don't want to say running on empty, but let's just say struggling to deliver up till now. And how is this likely to make it even worse? Not even to talk about the fact that Medicaid cuts are being debated in the House right now.
And again, a lot of the best answer for that is just to highlight the uncertainty that exists in the environment. It's very hard to plan for the future. It's very hard to know who to hire, how to hire, and where, without knowing what's coming down the pike. But the Maine being a rural state, we have been suffering. You know, for a long time. I was reading an article actually this morning. The headline was, "We've had a rural healthcare crisis for 15 years," and that's what my experience has been. I'm always hesitant to go too far into the subject, even because I will start with saying that any discussion about the delivery system itself, to me, is a discussion about rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. Until we have a universal system, that a universal financing system in this country, like we do in every other industrialized country, we are going to have incredible amount of inefficiency and difficulty in planning and structuring population-based solution to healthcare problems, because it is such a fragmented system, and that all goes back to our financing system. There are a variety of programs that were introduced over the past 20, 30 years, the critical access hospital system, the community health, community health center system, that are really no more than plugging holes in that broken financial system, because there was a recognition that we needed to find a way to finance rural hospitals. We needed to find a way to finance rural primary care providers. So we created this plug, and none of those plugs work well together. And we're seeing that in Maine and throughout the country. We've lost another hospital, or in the process of losing another hospital in Waterville. There's been 193 rural hospitals have closed since 2005.
Nationwide.
Nationwide, and that number grows every day. And the main hospitals right now are very challenged, but part of that is some state challenges with the with Medicaid funding. Everyone is looking with trepidation as to what the budget
Wow. And of course, we're just in the middle of this debate with the MDI hospital about closing its birthing center, and these rural birthing centers are closing apparently all over Maine, which is part of the problem of being in a rural area.
And again, I'll go back to maternal health is a huge issue, and it's not a Maine issue. It's not an MDI issue, although I know it is in some sense. But it's a national issue. There are OB deserts throughout the country. Again, not having a financing system that is consistent throughout the service areas, it's very hard to develop a regional solution to provide good maternal care. The biggest challenge when you lose obstetrical services in a community of delivery services, the biggest challenge that you have, aside from the immediate challenge to having a safe delivery, is having the expertise in that community to provide effective prenatal and postpartum care.
Yeah. Do you see the policies that are shaping up from the federal administration making it worse? I mean, obviously,
I think
universal health care is probably not on the table, but.
it's hard for me, quite frankly, to rationalize what those policies look like, because they have not been particularly consistent. But in general, the issue is they're not taking, they don't seem to be interested in engaging in those public discussions of finding those solutions.
Yeah.
And that's what we need.
Well, wow, it's looking pretty bleak out there. I want to go back to the public health side and talk a little bit. I know this isn't a CDC type of problem, but food safety, food inspections, disease transmission through contamination. What do you think about that, Nirav?
You know, not long ago, I was meeting with some colleagues here in Maine, public health professionals here in Maine, just about a week ago. And the thrust of my discussion with them was, notwithstanding some of the concerns that are on the horizon, which we've detailed, what are ways that public health groups, state departments, and others can position themselves to work with the administration on areas of mutual concern? Chief among those was at the intersection of food safety, as well as concerns that have been laid forth by Secretary Kennedy around additives, dyes, things of that nature. One of the challenges here is figuring out, and Art has already referenced this, what the plan is. The uncertainty makes it difficult to plan, but certainly keeping the food system safe is a top priority and has been in our country for well over 100 years. At the same time, and the secretary has voiced support for that, at the same time, the group within FDA that does a lot of the inspections of food facilities, many of them have been let go. Like I can't speak for USDA, but there's also a component of that that happens at USDA. I don't have the facts on what's happened there. Likewise, with the approach to reducing additives and harmful chemicals in food, something we can all get behind. There's no doubt that there is room to improve the purity of the foods we eat from a processing standpoint, et cetera. That too, it is one thing to say that as an organizing principle. It is another thing to turn that into policy. And thus far, what we've seen is a call to remove 8 food dyes from the US FDA's list of approved dyes, an addition of 3 natural dyes. Fine, I don't know the science behind those, but sure. But that is hardly the entirety of the problem. And so the question I put back is, what's the plan? If we're going to focus on a less processed, more pure food supply, it's got to be more than just a couple of food dyes. What's the big plan? And I will say, even the administration seems to be at odds with itself on matters of food and water safety. Folks may have noticed that just in the past 24 hours, a report in the Washington Post talks about a plan, not yet confirmed, but on the EPA side, to roll back some of the regulations on 4 PFAS chemicals. Now, there are still regulations that will be in place for 2 others. So it's not a wholesale rollback, but a partial rollback. And again, it begs the question, what's the plan?
Amy, go ahead.
I mean, I think if we just look back at the last month or two when it comes to tariffs, unrelated subject, but there was no plan. It's just complete chaos. Raise them one day, lower them another day, change, use some undecipherable formula initially for different countries. And so I really think that's what we're facing. I mean, there's some big picture sorts of things. You have the impact of the folks from the really anti-government side, Heritage Foundation, who want to dismantle a lot of what the federal government does and has, laid that out, in the infamous Project 2025. But when it comes to specific administrative developments, it hasn't been much of a plan. And that is incredibly hard to others for others to react to. And I'd also add that when it comes to like getting rid of regulations, there's nothing in the US political system that allows anybody, whether it's an agency or the president, just to snap their fingers and it happens. You can have executive orders, but you can litigate any changes in rules. And there's whether it's done by an executive order or not. And there has to be there has to be some process that's found. We have this thing called the Administrative, I believe it's called the Administrative Procedures Act, and you can bring litigation because the change that's been proposed is deemed arbitrary and capricious. It's not based on science. So if you say, okay, we're going to like, let's say, remove approval of a pill that's used for medication abortion or set of pills for medication abortion, and you just release that. That hasn't been done. But let's say it happens. You to really defend that, you would have had to go through a whole process where you show that there have been studies that support this. You would have had to have a public comment period. So I think besides the lack of planning and the chaos, things are being done in a way that it's hard to know what's going to stick. And that's a part of the chaos too.
Well, speaking of the chaos, I think, you know, I want to turn for a minute to like the mental health. Like, this is a public health crisis in its own. People are stressed out. You know, a couple of the people that work on that work with me on this work in psychiatric fields, and they just say the people that they're seeing are stressed out. So is this causing sort of a mental health crisis, the uncertainty itself, regardless of the damage done by these policies? Go ahead, Nirav.
I welcome Art and Amy to weigh in as well. I don't know the answer, and it is plausible, but to be candid, I haven't seen concrete data to suggest that the ad hoc approach, the chaos, the lack of a plan has, as of this point, yielded that sort of stress. What I have seen, though, somewhat related, not so much mental health, but just speaking of stress, just since I've been back in Maine, I've had the opportunity to meet with some folks here, two in particular, two food banks, one in my neck of the woods and then one a bit further south in Freeport, both of whom noted that, although, again, not mental health, but very important, cuts to food assistance that comes from the USDA have directly impacted their operations. One of the two, and I won't name them for their own benefits, but one of the two institutions that I met with indicated that in April, the volume of food that they received from the USDA program was down by 30%. And thus, and then in May, it's projected to be down by 20%. Now, they get food from other sources. That's not all the food they get, but it was still a sizable chunk. And that is then being felt by the people they serve. Not, the people is an abstract term. The people they serve are our friends and neighbors here in Maine, who are now directly feeling the impact of some of these pullbacks. And that, well, you have to start wondering what it means to be a community if we can't feed our friends and neighbors.
Yeah. Stress, anybody else want to weigh in? Art?
I'll just jump in to echo that while I don't have any hard data or hard references to make, I do serve on a number of local boards. And just the stress level at those boards is palpable. I'm on the board of one of the public health agencies here in the county, and you know every employee there is wondering what's going to be happening, because most of the work that that they do is funded either directly or indirectly through some federal funds, and it's you know it's a natural reaction. So I think that there's just an awful lot of tension, really, in every interaction that I have.
You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Art Blank, whom you just heard from, former CEO of MDI Hospital, Amy Fried, Professor Emerita of Political Science at the University of Maine, and Nirav Shah, former director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and also former principal deputy director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Our topic today is, our government making us sick? And let's just turn for the last quarter of our show to the pushback. Like, who is pushing back on this? What can we do? Who is doing what? Are philanthropists stepping up? Bloomberg, Gates, you know, where is the action in terms of pushback on this? And what can we ourselves as ordinary people do to preserve our own well-being and to preserve the well-being of our neighbors and communities? That's a big, big, long question. Who wants to jump into the deep end here? Nirav, you go first.
Well, sure thing. And again, I certainly want to hear from both of my colleagues who have insights here. The answer with respect to responses to this, there has been varying degrees of pushback. I will say in my world, in the public health world, much of that has come from the medical and public health community itself. Whether it's on the safety and efficacy of vaccines or the need for sustained public health funding to do some of the things that I talked about at the top of the program. There have certainly been loud and clear voices who have stood up for the need to have a well-funded CDC and who have stood up to the fact that vaccines are necessary and have alleviated untoward amounts of disease and suffering. And that's been great to see, especially at a time where not everyone at the US CDC feels empowered to speak up on behalf of the agency. So that organized voice has been really, really helpful, and I think has been beneficial. And of course, they're not just speaking to those of us in the public, they're also speaking to our colleagues in Congress who, and I'll certainly let the card-carrying political scientists weigh in, but there are mechanisms that our colleagues in Congress could be taking that would also help put a stop to much of this.
Go ahead then, Amy.
Yeah, I would, I agree with everything just said. I'd add to it some patient groups. I'd like to actually see a little bit more of that, but I've seen some of that more just informally from, like certain cancer patient Facebook groups, people starting to do a little bit more. The state of Maine has been involved in bringing various lawsuits to restore funding as you typically as part of a consortium of other states. There's what we could call the resistance, different groups that are having protests that I think there is an interest in healthcare, and there's going to be even more of an interest as the budget goes forward and people see what's happening with Medicaid and other aspects of the federal budget. And that is where, Dr. Shah pointed out, that it really matters what our federal delegation does here, between how they vote, how they speak out, who they put pressure on. We have a Senator Collins, who's the head of the Senate Appropriations Committee. She did have one hearing where she brought some people in who were doing medical research, but she could be doing more to focus on the issue and to, bring in perhaps, some of the federal officials. She didn't question any federal officials in that first committee hearing, but they're all going to be voting on healthcare funding, and they also have to be standing up for the right of Congress to set budgets, which constitutionally that is their role. And the cuts that are happening that are just happening without regard to Congress are really illegitimate, and I would argue illegal and unconstitutional.
I know some of the groups that are some of the institutions that are getting the most hurt by this are also afraid of retribution. And we saw a U.S. Senator Murkowski, go on the record and say retribution is real, the fear is real. So with some of the people and institutions who are being most impacted by this needing to protect their own constituents with their silence, what can we, the rest of us, do to pick up the slack and help protect the food banks, for example, and the others that are getting most hurt by this?
I'll offer two very brief points. The first is, you sort of referenced this, but I want to give voice to it. In my view, and there are certainly dissenting views on this, but in my view, the thing that we in Maine can do to try to counteract or act as a ballast against some of these things is to help out here at home. Helping your friends and neighbors, whether it's through supporting a local food bank or countless other ways to help out, volunteering in various and different ways. My view is that the surest way to try to reduce the impact of some of these cuts is to focus our efforts helping at home. That is not to take away from folks who wish to give to global charities and things of that nature. Certainly no disagreement there, but my sense is I want to try to reduce the amount of harm that comes to folks here. The other is from an advocacy perspective. And Amy has already sort of referenced this, but when I was in my prior post, one of the things I observed was that advocacy that was particularly effective was not just a litany of statistics and numbers, but rather a story. a story where the person that you are advocating to, be it a U.S. senator or a staff member or a member of the press, a story where they and their audience can see themselves is ultimately what changes minds. Having some facts and figures in there is always nice, but a story is what ultimately moves folks from thinking about something toward action.
And that's why, you know, in a way, Amy, your personal story was pretty powerful, talking about your own cancer diagnosis and the future treatments that you might be deprived of. Go ahead, speak to that for a second.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, with all maladies, there's ongoing research, and in, you know, we have so many, there's been so much progress in so many areas, but then there's, you know, a lot that haven't. I mean, I talked a little bit about a clinical trial that was going on. I don't remember how much detail I gave, but as a doctor at Sloan Kettering in New York, heading this, it's really an international trial. You know, and you know, that could really be, there had been before she did this work, no FDA approved treatments for recurrence of low grade serous ovarian cancer.
Which
is what I have. So that, you know, there's other things that people have tried and there's some evidence for, but you know, nothing that had the approval, partly because it is relatively rare, but still. But you know, and then you look at something like pancreatic cancer, which we all know, like, the statistics are really, really dire. And then there's something that's, you know, I don't, you know, it's in development at least, and I think really good promise with a kind of vaccine. I think it uses mRNA as a basis, and you have an administration that for some reason has it out for mRNA in general, you know, and you know, I'm probably, everybody here knows, and at least I know, you know, at least one person who died from pancreatic cancer, you know, and you get the diagnosis and it's, you know, I think she lived 8 months, the person that I'm thinking of. And it was just after her husband retired and they moved to a place on a lake that they had planned to move to after retirement, you know? So you just think of all these years that they had these expectations and, you know, they had some very small grandchildren. Their grandchildren could have been there all these years visiting her, you know, loved to cook and entertain and play, you know, and then in her case, okay, that was a while ago, but all the future people now, all the people now with the disease or who will be diagnosed in the next few years.
And,
you know,
and that's where the connecting the dots point that Nirav was making earlier. I mean, it's difficult to tie future deaths to the absence of treatment or to a particular thing that's happening now, having caused that future circumstance. But I mean, I think you're all sort of saying people are going to die. Go ahead, Art.
Well, first of all, I saw an estimate that 200,000 people have already died from the cuts in USAID.
Really? Yes.
Which, again, if you go through the nature of the work that they did, it's not even surprising. But yeah, the underlying system that we have for both caring for people and improving the environment in which they live in, those systems require a coordinated public effort to maintain them effectively. We can't, you know, there's a reason why we come together to provide police protection and fire protection. Well, we do the same thing to protect our health. And that's why we have Medicare, and that's why we have Medicaid, and that's why we've got all of these patchwork programs to try to create a health system. And if you take away the tools of those health systems, One thing we haven't mentioned, these tariffs. Well, we although a lot of our medical equipment, the technology, comes from the great work of our researchers here. Like a lot of other things, there many of them are manufactured elsewhere.
Elsewhere. Yeah. All
And
right. We are
so,
running out of
yeah.
time this afternoon, so I'm going to try to give you each a minute with your parting thoughts. And since I kind of cut you off there, Art, I'll let you make a parting thought first.
So my parting thought is that, and I'll reference something I think Nora said earlier. There is no plan. And the fact that there's been, rather than exercising a plan, there's been just chaos, freezing funds, canceling programs, firing people. It's going to have ripple effects throughout our economy and throughout our healthcare system, and that is going to cause people to die.
Yeah.
I do think there's a core discussion that needs to take place about the role of government, as well as eliminate as backtracking on all this uncertainty.
Yeah. Go ahead, Amy. Parting shot.
There's going to be a lot of details in the health policy debates, and I think in a way, it's not necessary to follow all of them. Let the people who really are working on it follow them, but speak out about avoiding cuts, restoring what's been there before, and keep working on, keep advocating for expanding. It may not seem like it's possible right now, but it's worth talking about and talking about it in terms of how it affects you and your family.
Nirav, last word.
Well, first, thank you for having me. Public health has always been politicized since its very inception, and we're seeing an outgrowth of that. We're seeing the consequences of that. Even though the impact of some of these cuts will be felt most by the current administration's base, rural voters here in Maine in particular, we are not without options to push back. We've already talked about many of them. I will reinforce working with, volunteering with, and helping your friends and neighbors in your community is a great way to offset some of these impacts.
Thank you all so much. That's our show for today. Our guests this afternoon were Art Blank, former CEO of MDI Hospital, Amy Freed, Professor Emerita of Political Science at the University of Maine, and Nirav Shah, the former director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the former principal deputy director of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum, a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. We're streaming at WERU.org. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@WERU.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org. For more information about this topic, you can read some great articles there that reflect on what we've been talking about, or to learn about other shows in our series. And you can subscribe to our podcast also at lwvme.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all next month.